Well, if I could ask God one question and I knew that he would answer me, then what might that question be? That's a question that we always begin our Food for Thought course with. Some of you will be familiar with that course. It's a course which allows people to come and to examine the Christian faith for themselves. And on the very first night, that is a question which we always ask. I don't know what your question might be this evening. If you could ask God one question and you knew that he would answer it. That's the question which lies behind this new Sunday evening series. And it's behind the book by the same title, which I want to commend to you because you may like to take it and read it and perhaps even give it away as a gift as this series progresses. But it's a book which has prompted this series, and there are many questions in it which we're going to look at over the course of these Sunday evenings together. The purpose of this series, as I said a few minutes ago, is actually to equip us as Christians to be a little more confident in being able to answer some of the big questions which people are asking. This book really has been put together because these are really some of the top questions which people are asking today in terms of the Christian faith. If you look at the church program card, you'll have seen by now that we're going to look at a whole range of topics together. What about other religions? If I can be forgiven, then why can't I live as I please? Why does God allow suffering? How can anyone be sure about life after death? Isn't there a conflict between Christianity and science? If God is a God of love, then why create hell? Isn't the Bible just a bunch of made-up stories? And the question which we're going to look at this evening is a question in regard to the existence of God. If you are really there, God, then why don't you prove it? I was very tempted when I started to look at this question. I have to admit, quite late on Friday afternoon this week, I was a bit behind in my preparation. I was tempted to take this book and read the first chapter to you this evening. I thought if I read it fairly slowly, we could sort of get through it in about 20 minutes. But I don't want to spoil the book, okay? So we're not going to do that this evening because I want you to take the book and to read it. But I will start with an illustration that you'll find in the first chapter that really kind of caught my imagination. It's a story which you may have heard before, which took place in a primary school where children were asked to paint or to draw something which they had done over the previous weekend. The teacher says, if you don't know what to paint, just paint something. So, as good children do, they began to put on their little aprons and to paint rather enthusiastically, and the teacher began to wander around the classroom, see what the children were up to, and some were painting pictures of mummy and daddy, and some were painting pictures of animals that they visited in the zoo, and some were painting pictures of the seaside. And eventually the teacher stopped over one particularly shapeless but very colourful painting. "That's nice, Scott," she said to the little boy, hoping to encourage him. But she said to him, "What is it?" Scott looked at her and said, "Well, it's easy, that's God." Teacher said, "But no one's ever seen God before." "Well," said Scott, with his little innocent face looking at the teacher, "well, now they have." I want to suggest to you this evening that it's not only small children who paint pictures of God. It's something that human beings have been doing from the very beginning of time. Some have painted gods in the picture of animals, or in the shape of fire or water, gods in the stars, gods in the sun. There have been gods who are distant, there have been gods who are far away, and there have been gods who are close and fearsome. And the question that we want to look at together this evening is, if you are really their God, then why on earth don't you prove it? Does God exist or not? Is there anyone there? How would you answer that question? If someone confronted you tomorrow morning, you're having a cup of coffee, wherever you may be, and someone says to you, "How can you prove God's existence?" And you say, "Well, it's so funny you should say that, because last night in church we had, and I was able to answer it." Well, let's see how we get on with this question this evening. The Apostle Paul answers that question in no uncertain terms when he writes to a church in Rome. And amongst the opening remarks you'll find in chapter 1 and verse 20, Paul says, actually, human beings are without excuse when it comes to understanding the existence of God. And then he writes these words. He says, "For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that we are without excuse." And what Paul is doing there is essentially pointing us to divine fingerprints, which is what I like to describe them as, where God has revealed himself to us through the world that he has created. I'm told that there are between 2 and 3 dozen very good arguments for the existence of God. Now, you're looking a little concerned this evening. I'm going to just pick 5 of those tonight. If you want to examine this subject in a lot more detail, let me recommend a second book this evening. This is an excellent book by Tim Keller, The Reason for God, Belief in an Age of Skepticism. Now, it's a little heavier than the other book that I recommended to you, but it makes very good reading. So what can we look at? How can we prove the existence of God from nature? Well, let's look at 5 things in particular. Firstly, clue number 1. The first divine fingerprint, if you like, this evening is what I've described as the mysterious bang. Or to put it in very simple terms, how come there is something rather than nothing? Stephen Hawkins, who's no real friend of those who are Christians, writes, almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. The fact that there is something rather than nothing leaves you with 2 possibilities. Either you have to come to the conclusion that our physical universe is capable of ordering itself all by itself. It has just put itself together by some kind of random chance. Or that there is in fact something that leads us to believe that God created the world in which we live. And this mysterious Big Bang is a very provocative clue for many people. The second clue I want to highlight this evening is what we might describe as the complexity of our universe. The natural world in which we live, which has been highlighted by so many nature programs in recent years, is a wonderful and stunningly complex and beautiful creation. It is full of the most intricately and finely balanced processes. Sir James Jean, a famous British astronomer, once said, "The universe appears to have been designed by a pure mathematician. For him, the order of the Earth, the solar system, and the universe points to a master planner." Did you know, for example, that the Earth is tilted at exactly 23 degrees? Did you know that that finely tuned balance allows for our seasons of summer and autumn and winter and spring? Did you know that if that balance was out even by a half degree, that the vapors from all of the oceans would move north and south, would produce ice caps which would eventually cover the entire world? Did you know that if the crust of the earth was just 10 feet thicker, there would be no oxygen and no human life or animal life could exist? Did you know, for example, that the weight of the earth has been calculated to be in the region of 6 sextillion tons? Now that's 6 followed by 23 zeros. That's pretty heavy. Yet it is perfectly balanced. It rotates at 1,000 miles an hour. It travels about 25,000 miles a day and covers 9 million miles a year. Maybe that's why some of you feel a little tired this evening. Because you've travelled 25,000 miles since you woke up this morning. And by the end of the year, you'll have travelled 9 million miles if you've never even left your house. It doesn't really make any sense, does it, to suggest that this could have happened by some kind of chance, random accident. As a clue, it certainly points us towards the existence of a creator God. And many people have looked at our world and have concluded that it seems to be designed in a particular way for human beings and for animal life to survive. The third clue I want to point you to this evening is the existence of personality. It's surprising how many people prefer to believe that we are just a product of some kind of random explosion that took place millions of years ago. I came across a fascinating description of human beings that I wanted to share with you this evening from a scientist who believes that we are just a product of some chance explosion. This is how he describes you and me. He says, "You are nothing but a complex biochemical mechanism powered by a combustion system which energizes computers with prodigious storage facilities for retaining encoded information." That's not a lovely way to be described. Personalities, on the other hand, argue that we are more than machines. We are more than just a flow of energy, of colliding atoms and molecules. People are the most profound beings in the world. We have the ability to experience a whole range of emotions. We can love, we can hate, we can feel, we can decide. We have with us appetites and desires. St. Augustine, one of the early church fathers, reasoned that these desires are in fact clues to the reality of God, and that the existence of personality points us at least in the direction that we have a creator God who is a real person. Clue number four to the existence of God is the existence of morality. We at least have to ask the question, why is it that all human beings seem to have this inbuilt understanding of what is right and what is wrong? Where does that sense of morality come from? We may not always agree on what is right and what is wrong. Often our cultures can influence that sense of what is right and what is wrong, but there is often a general consensus. But we all know that right and wrong exists. You observe children who are playing at a very young age, and you will see that there is an inbuilt understanding that some things are right and some things are wrong. You watch one of the deepest ethical debates in our society taking place on television, and people have this innate understanding that something is right and something is wrong. Where does that come from? Could it be that behind the laws of right and wrong, there exists a lawgiver, or as someone has put it, that our mental software has a programmer? Clue number five is what people have often described as a thirst for something more. It seems as you study the cultures of our world, that whatever culture you enter or whatever period of history you study, people have always had some kind of religious dimension to their lives. It's as if deep down people have this understanding that there is something more than we can touch and feel around us. An awareness of another reality. A dimension to life that can't simply be explained away by the laws of science. That people seem to have a thirst that cannot be satisfied by the things of this world. That sense of thirst is often described as a spiritual thirst or a spiritual hunger. I mentioned Augustine a few minutes ago. He's a man who lived a long time ago. And yet he embarked on his own spiritual search, and he wrote these words out of his own experience. God, you have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. Could it be then that this thirst for something more suggests that we are built for a relationship with this God who exists? Here are five clues, which we've covered very, very quickly this evening. But as I mentioned to you, there are at least two or three dozen very good arguments for the existence of God. There is, however, a much more compelling argument for the existence of God. It's based on a number of Christian convictions, convictions that were written down by many people who wanted to keep a record of the extraordinary events that surrounded the life and the death and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Convictions and beliefs that point us beyond these divine fingerprints to the God that we've been looking for. Let me highlight four of those convictions this evening. Firstly, and you will need to take your Bible at this stage, because I'm going to look at a few references with you as we just work our way through these four convictions this evening. But you'll find it helpful to have this in front of you tonight. The first Christian conviction is that God is a God who speaks to us. And I want to draw your attention to three verses at the beginning of the book of Hebrews. If you're struggling to find that in the Bible, you'll find it on page 1201. Chapter 1, verse 1. In the past, God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, and through whom he made the universe. The Son, Jesus Christ, is the radiance of God's glory. And look at this next phrase. And the exact representation of God's being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. I want to suggest to you tonight that as Christians we believe that God has revealed himself to us in ways that we can understand. God has not entered into some kind of cosmic hide-and-seek game where we have to search and search and search until we find him. That God speaks to us through the Bible. And as the writer of the Hebrews says here, that in this last period of history, God has spoken to us through his Son Jesus Christ, who is described in these verses as being the exact representation of the being of God. Now later in this series we'll look together at why we can trust the Bible. Why the Bible isn't just a bunch of made up stories. But it is our conviction as Christian people that God is a God who speaks to us, which is why God is referred to as the Word at the beginning of John's Gospel. There's the first Christian conviction, that God is a God who speaks to us. The second Christian conviction is that God, well, these numbers are roaming around, but never mind, that God is a God. Nope, number two. We've got it right after all. That Jesus Christ claimed to be God. The second Christian conviction is that Jesus Christ claimed to be God. Now let's go to John chapter 14 and to a curious conversation that takes place between Jesus and a man called Philip. Philip in John chapter 14 is asking the question that we're looking at together tonight. In chapter 14 and verse 8, Philip is saying to Jesus, "Lord, show us the Father, show us God. Prove to us that God exists. If you're really God, their God, then prove it." And Jesus seems surprised that Philip could even ask such a question in verse 9. He says, "Don't you know me, Philip? Even after I have been among you such a long time." And look at this staggering claim which Jesus makes next. "Anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, 'Show us the Father'? Don't you believe that I am in the Father and that the Father is in me? The words I say to you are not just my own. Rather, it is the Father living in me who is doing his work." The second great Christian conviction is that Jesus claimed to be God. In other words, all the guessing games are over. The divine fingerprints, although we've only looked at five tonight, and there could be two or three dozen, are in fact all leading us towards the person of Jesus Christ, which is why Paul writes in Romans chapter 1 that we are without excuse. And as you read through the New Testament, we're told again and again by people who met with Jesus that he really was who he claimed to be. And ultimately, he vindicated those claims through his death and resurrection. Turn back to chapter 1 and verse 14 of John's Gospel, and you see the conviction which John has as he writes his account about the life and the death and the resurrection of Jesus. He says in chapter 1 and verse 14, "The Word," which is another way of describing God, "became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace in truth." And John was convinced that Jesus Christ claimed to be God. The third Christian conviction is that Jesus Christ acted as if he was God in God's world. At the end of Matthew's Gospel is a wonderful verse where Jesus comes to his disciples and he says to them, "All authority has been given to me. All authority in heaven and on earth belongs to me." And throughout Jesus' life, he demonstrated that authority. He demonstrated his authority over sickness by healing people who came to him. He demonstrated his authority over nature by standing one day and stilling a huge storm that was taking place, by suspending the laws of nature on other occasions. He demonstrated his authority over evil by releasing people who were being oppressed by evil spirits and spiritual darkness. He demonstrated his authority over death by raising people from the dead during his lifetime. He claimed to be able to have authority to forgive sin, which is something clearly, according to those who wrote these words down, was something that only God could do. Jesus even predicted his own death and resurrection, and 3 days after his death, he rose again. Everywhere that Jesus went, he claimed to be God, and he even applied the name of God to himself, not once, but again and again and again. Everywhere he went, he acted as if he was God, doing the things that only God could do in his world, and claiming that if we have seen him, we have seen the Father, that through him, God has proved his existence to us beyond reasonable doubt. That however staggering the implications of Jesus' actions and words may be, Jesus has proved to us that he is God. And that brings us to the fourth conviction, that Jesus has made it possible for us to encounter God today? Now let's just look at John chapter 7 and verse 17, where you'll see Jesus makes an amazing invitation for people to put his teaching to the test. It's a great invitation to the skeptic. It's a great invitation to people who want to put the claims of Jesus to the test, but it requires a step of faith, because Jesus says, if anyone chooses to do God's will, he will find out whether my teaching comes from God or whether I speak on my own. It's an invitation to consider the facts, the divine fingerprints that we've been looking at tonight, the claims which Jesus himself made, and to step out in faith. There's a wonderful verse in the Bible that says, if you seek God with all of your heart, you will find him. And that's behind the invitation which Jesus makes here in verse 17 of chapter 7. And many of you who are here tonight have discovered that relationship with God that Jesus speaks about so often. And I want to encourage you tonight by urging you not to hold back from telling people that you walk and you talk regularly with a God who is there and can be known. You have no reason to cower when someone challenges your faith, because our faith is not based on shifting sand or something that's liable to collapse or to subside. I hope that tonight at least gives you a taster that you can depend on what you believe, that these five divine fingerprints that we've been thinking of do lead us to God. The mysterious Big Bang. How come there is something rather than nothing? The complexity of the universe. It's intricately balanced in such a way that even shifting the earth by a half degree means that we could no longer live on it. The evidence of our personality. The existence of morality. This thirst for something more. And that the Christian convictions that we hold are true. That God is a God who speaks to us, and in these last days he has spoken to us through Jesus Christ. Now here are some of the things which he has said to us. Jesus Christ is the Son of God. Jesus acted as if he was God, and Jesus makes the amazing claim. He says, if you want to know God, then you come to him through me. It may well be that some of you are here tonight, or those who may listen to this service on our website later, might describe yourself as someone's on the outside looking in this evening. You've got all of these questions. If you are really there, God, then why don't you prove it? You're still weighing up the evidence. You're thinking about the divine fingerprints. If that describes you, I have a suggestion for you. The next time that God prompts you in your thinking, which he will from time to time, why not say something like this to him? Okay, I know you're real. But I need you to prove it to me. I need you to help me to understand who you are. I need you to help me to accept this invitation from Jesus to find out whether or not his teaching comes from you or not. It doesn't make sense to me right now. But help me to understand that you have proved your existence through the person of Jesus Christ, so that I too can encounter a God who really exists. If you are really there, God, then why on earth don't you prove it? I don't know about you, but my own conviction is that as Jesus walked this planet, that God proved here on earth that he really does exist. And if we put into practice the invitation to search with all of our hearts, we will find. And we will discover that God really exists. Let's take a moment to reflect on some of the things we've been thinking about. We've covered a lot of ground in a very short period of time this evening, which is why I recommend these books to you, because these Sunday nights are little more than a taster on some of these subjects. But let's take some moments to pray.